The Guardian.
Welcome to The Observer Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's chart-climbing podcast, we meet the inventor of the docu-fantasia, Guy Maddin, as he tries to escape his hometown of Winnipeg.
Well, I'd really hoped with this movie to just pile up an Everest of Winnipeg specificities, and somehow the sheer weight of those specific Winnipeg details would push through some barrier and make the picture universal.
And we'll be celebrating the great British film studios when I visit a unique new exhibition that captures the spirit of British cinema.
You know, when you look at something here, people really can start to understand how much goes into it, not just from a cost perspective, but the work, the time, the effort and the passion that goes behind making any one of these movies.
That's all on this week's Observer Film Weekly. And you, dear listener, have a chance to win a framed print from that Getty Images show in an amazing Film Weekly competition. More of that later. But first, Tom McCarthy's film, The Visitor, is a contemporary tale of cultural and political awakening, told through the eyes of a weary academic. Professor Walter Vale, played by Richard Jenkins, who's best known for his role as the ghostly father in 6 Feet Under, is a respectable widower on his way to New York to attend a conference when he finds unexpected visitors in his New York apartment. From that point on, his life takes a new turn as the mysterious Syrian drummer and his beautiful African girlfriend show to him a more complex side of life. I met up with director and writer Tom McCarthy to find out the genesis of his story. But first, let's hear a clip from his film, The Visitor.
Do you have keys?
Yes, of course
I have keys. This is my apartment.
Would you pass this on a button?
Show me your keys.
All right.
I've had this apartment for 25 years.
So why haven't you been here?
Because I live in Connecticut. I haven't been down here in a very long time.
Are you friends with Ivan?
Ivan? I don't know. Who's Ivan?
I'm sure he's called the police.
Did you call the police?
No.
You did not call the police?
No.
And you don't know Ivan?
No. Who is he?
He rented us this place.
I don't know.
He said it belonged to his friend who was out of town.
No, I don't know who he is. This is my apartment. I assure you.
Hey, look. We don't want any trouble. We will get out of your apartment. Here, take your keys. It's all a mistake, I'm sorry. We will leave, okay?
Okay.
It was an interesting process, this story, because it did start with Richard's character, and then quickly I sort of came up with the idea for this other character of Tariq, the Syrian musician who plays the djembe. And it just that resulted from some people I met when I was spending some time in Beirut and the sort of spirit and generosity and enthusiasm these people had for their art. And, you know, I was like, how do I bring these two guys together? And then it was in the process of that I sort of started stumbling on more and more of these immigration stories and felt like it was an interesting storyline to include. Mm. But, you know, for me, first and foremost, it was a character study of not just those two guys, but the young guy's girlfriend and ultimately his mother, too, who enters the picture. And how these four people, through a trying time, still manage to form friendship and even love and connect in awkward and funny and in sometimes dramatic ways.
It happens quite quickly. It feels quite quick in the movie, and yeah. It is quite quick. They draw attention to it. They say, wow, this has only been 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to draw attention to that time scale and to make it happen so quickly?
It just felt natural to the – really, it just kept coming back to, like, what was organic to the characters and when we pick them up and when they meet and then when just one random incident sort of changes the direction of the film and of their lives ultimately and how random that can be, right? You step off the curb, look the wrong way, and there it is. So I was kind of fascinated with moments like that aren't too manipulated, that don't feel too serendipitous, but are really rooted in sort of who the character is.
You know? I mean, the station agent, I was trying to, as one does with a writer-director, one looks for kind of, especially you, because you have an actor, so you're often playing other people's lines, other people's parts, just saying other people's words and, you know, embodying other people's themes. So as you were writing and directing, I'm wondering, well, what's this guy's thing? What makes him tick? And the station agent, I suppose, is also about serendipitous meetings and tracks running, you know, journeys, I suppose, stretching onto the distance. There's all those shots of the journeys that could take us. And there's what is that? Is that what? Am I right in divining that? Or are you just kind of about writing good parts for good people?
Probably a little bit of both. I think I am really interested in just connections people form and the sort of tension that's that develops from that, and bringing people together that don't that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think is meeting, but
it's like the odd couple.
Yeah, and also, it strikes me as a very New York sort of thing, and probably very London also. These cities where people come from all over the world, literally, and can't help but bumping into each other occasionally, and sometimes that results in a simple "excuse me, pardon me," and sometimes it results in something much deeper. So that always has fascinated me.
Mm-hmm. And this one, there's obviously a big cultural divide that they kind of cross, the other side of the tracks in the station agent, but this is this is another side of a kind of a world divide. This is classical music versus music of the soul versus African drumming, if you like. Where did the musical element come in? Because it forms quite a big part of this, but it feels like that it was, you know, that it was kind of worked at. That you kind of arrived at, hey, we could make him drum and we could listen to Fela Kuti.
Yeah, I think that honestly, I think the Fela stuff and the drumming was one of the early seeds of this whole piece. That was because I had seen one of those drum circles in Central. I used to live up near Central Park, and there's always those drum circles, and I just thought it was, you know, talking to those guys, and they are the guys you see in the movie are the guys who are there every week.
They're the real drum circle
group. This is the 10 people. We said, can you guys come next Thursday? And they showed up. In fact, they came to our premiere and played. It was hilarious. Yeah, and they're just the nicest group of guys, and it's how they make their living. Most of them doing that, and most of them just have a great time. They invite anyone to join. If you got a drum or any instrument, you can sit down and join them. And people end up a lot of the people you see in that montage scene who are dancing and having a good time, those are not those aren't extras. Those are New Yorkers or visitors or tourists or what have you. So that kind of there's something about those drum circles and the drumming which I found to be very intriguing. Mm. And that's sort of quickly where I knew Tarek was going to play the instrument. And there's something I just liked about him playing the drum and being a part of this jazz trio, which is a slightly more sophisticated sound than, say, the drum circle. But I think it says a little bit about him and his background, musical background.
I like the shots from Queens that you get the feeling that this narrative is happening in the shadow of other things, in the shadow of New York's bigger stories or more glamorous stories, let's say. And this detention house in, is it Queens? I've only been to Queens once to an art gallery, so that was a rather
pretty different place.
Yes, but it was a kind of big foreboding place, and I love the way that was contrasted with Ellis Island when they go to Staten Island. I mean, Ellis Island, which is where my ancestors to have come to New York, they would have gone there for sure. And it seems that these are the new Ellis Islands.
Yeah, I think so. I think in many ways they are, but you know, they're out there in those industrial parks for a reason, and that's because many of these people are sort of being swept under the rug, mm-hmm. out of sight, out of mind.
And those are true places. That's where
reconstruct it, but yeah, absolutely. There's one. There was the one I visited for a long time in doing research was in Queens, and then they eventually shut that. And then I started visiting one in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which is just on the other side of the river in a similar, near Newark Airport, so in a similar industrial park. And I included that storyline of the detention center because I was just visited one on a lark research and was just blown away by these places. I knew nothing about them and didn't know they exist, and they're creepy places.
Now, one could sort of say that your film is in a good liberal tradition. It's about kind of crossing barriers. It's about a man changing his mind for essentially an alien, not alien from outer space, but I suppose that is the kind of arc as well.
A visitor.
But, yes. there will be people maybe that say to you, Tom, that, you know, after 9/11, we need to be careful of all these people. We never know who an immigrant is, who an Arab is, if they're good or a bad person. Have you met some with resistance for that from your film? Because your film is very much on the side of the liberals.
Yes and no. You know, I think it is and it isn't. I mean, you know, look, in the film, you know, his mother has committed a crime. She admits it, and she's done wrong, and laws have to be enforced and abided by, and immigration is ridiculously tricky topic. It's not as simple as, like, people should be able to come and go as they please. I don't believe that, because it's naive to some degree. It's a wonderful utopian idea, but it's naive, especially in this world where there are real dangers and real economic pressures. So I think all those things have to be considered. All this movie does is really point out, and again, I think quite secondary to the relationships that are formed, which to me is almost a more important storyline, but points out a little bit these detention centers and says, hey, do we know about these? Do we know that it's being handled this way in our name? And if so, can we do it better? And my feeling is yes. And I you know, I guess anyone who would disagree with me on that, on the other side of the political spectrum or on my own, I would have to say, okay, have you visited them? And why do you think we're handling it well? Because they're just, you know, we're putting people away that don't have any connection to anyone. They don't have legal representation. Yeah. You know, if we're going to preach democracy to the world, then we've got to live up to that in our own country.
Tom McCarthy, lovely to see you. Thank you very much for coming on Film Weekly.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
The Visitor, already a sleeper hit in the US this summer, is on general release here from Friday the 4th of July. And Tom McCarthy, with his acting shoes on, will feature prominently in Series 5 of The Wire. In fact, Tom mentioned to me that this is probably what he's best known for here in the UK, although, as he went on to point out, the series has yet to make it to our shores, and therefore he presumes that most of his fans here are fond of the illegal download or two. And now, Film Weekly listeners, come with me on a little London adventure. A new photography exhibition capturing iconic behind-the-scenes images of some of the best in British film from the last 50 years at Pinewood, Shepperton and Teddington Studios has just opened at the Getty Images Gallery in East Castle Street in London's West End. I'm with the gallery director, Louise Garszewska, on the eve of the exhibition opening, Friday the 4th of July, and there are some wonderful images from the past 50 years of British film. Alfred Hitchcock peers down at me, Inspector Clouseau peers at me, and David Lean in the corner making up Alec Guinness's Fagin in their wonderful production of Oliver Twist. Louise, this is a collection that is quite staggering, the amount of acting ability that was here in the UK shores, and the talent, but also the talent of the stills photographers who've captured these people sort of when they're off camera.
Well, we've been working on this now for about the last year with Pinewood and the studios up there, and I think you've got a whole collection of photography which dates right the way back and shows the background behind the scenes to so many great and magnificent films.
The UK is clearly a kind of a hotbed of talent. If you look at the celebrities that we've attracted to films over the years, was that the sort of intent of the exhibition to reveal? I think people forget sometimes the wealth of British film history.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the biggest conversations that we had at the beginning was, well, how magnificent the British film industry is. People don't necessarily recognise that and tend to think of Pinewood as only being the Carry On. But in actual fact, you've got the underwater stages and you've got all the Bond movies. And I think what we've been able to do is to show the whole team that puts together a movie, not just the stars that you see on your screens.
I'm loving some of the clothes worn by the sort of the continuity ladies and the tea ladies and the costumiers. I'm going to walk past Peter Sellers and Bob Hope and Bing Crosby there in Pinewood. We're going to alight here right in front of Sid James and Kenneth Williams in one of the carry-ons, or having it looks like a tea break to me, Louise.
I think the great thing about it is that they are having a tea break. It is casual. It's completely relaxed, and you can see the way the characters come alive out of the photograph. I mean, you just want to feel like you're in there with them. And I think the quality and the production that our darkroom have managed to produce when they're shot is really, really first class.
Kenneth Williams' nose is turned up in his habitual disgust. I think he's probably had a taste of that Pinewood tea. But Sid James looks kind of always smirking, and the clear clarity of those eyes dancing with mischief.
I think also the character lines, I mean, that's not makeup. That is someone who loves what they do, and it really, really comes across.
I love the tea lady in the background there in her horn-rimmed glasses. And I think there's a pearl earring dangling away, but she's not looking at the reaction to her day's work of preparing that tea. Well, Sid and Kenneth are not far from a wonderfully lit shot that is from Cleopatra, Richard Burton and Liz Taylor, looking very happy there. She's having a glass of champagne, her legs crossed, fine legs she has. And this really takes us in behind one of the most expensive productions ever mounted in Pinewood's history.
The great thing you can see is all the old camera equipment that works really, really well. And as you were saying, we were talking earlier on, I think it was something like $33 million, the equivalent of sort of $300 million today, and one of the most expensive productions ever, ever made.
It's amazing because that's still expensive today as a budget.
It is.
Probably gone on Liz Taylor's fur hat.
But I think with Liz Taylor, I mean, the collection that we have within the archive is huge, as I was saying to you earlier on. And it doesn't matter what part she's playing, in what movie, what film, she always looks stunning.
Yeah. This is particularly fascinating as well, because I think Richard Burton's got his sort of normal shoes and normal trousers on, but he's wearing a toga and a sort of tunic there. There must be some sort of camera test or lighting test. Liz Taylor's totally relaxed there in her fishnet stockings. I don't think Cleopatra wore those. And coming to this absolutely splendid shot of Sean Connery. Is it Dr. No?
This is Thunderball, actually.
Thunderball, of course, yes, with Blofeld with his eye patch. It's a card game shot, but this isn't a still from a film. This is actually shot from the set.
Yes, actually shot from the set. And also, then, You Only Live Twice over here, where you're actually looking again. This is a Larry Ellis shot. He must have been up in the rafters of that shot in order to get all that film set to get that shot.
Yeah, we're looking at one of Ken Adams' legendary designs. That's futuristic design, where a rocket's going to kind of come out of the hole in the ground there. And this is the floor is milling with, well, it's not the people who are in the film. It's extras, it's kind of dolly men, it's kind of people delivering things. In fact, actually, the film itself always looked like that. The set was full of people coming in on cars. You never know who's kind of part of the crew and who's kind of part of the baddies or Smursh or whatever it was. It's an amazing shot, and as you say, the cameraman Larry Ellis must have got right into the roof there of Pinewood.
I think this exhibition really, the whole of this exhibition really illustrates the fabulousness, if you like, of British film. It's all about, you know, filmmaking in the history. And I think, you know, when you look at something here, people really can start to understand how much goes into it, not just from a cost perspective, but the work, the time, the effort and the passion that goes behind making any one of these movies.
And as we progress along, here's one of my favourites, Louise, in this exhibition. It's clearly 1966, and I say that because it's Bobby Moore and Jimmy Greaves having a pint, I think it's probably a shandy, in the company of Yul Brynner and Sean Connery. Who'd have put those four together in the back four defence? But they're being filmed, clearly it must be a publicity day when the England team got toured around Pinewood. Yul Brynner they're tight ski pants, little pixie boots there, and a sort of wind cheatery top that is probably quite modern. It looks quite cool. He was very cool, Yul, wasn't he?
He certainly was, actually. I didn't really imagine him like this. After watching him in The King and I, this is completely different.
We're looking at the wonderful images here, and that some are rehearsed and some are posed and some are completely caught and some are just sort of, they're almost publicity shots, but they're almost kind of publicity for filmmaking, as you say, for the craft of film that goes into it. There's something different, isn't there? There's film stills, there's film itself, and then there are these photographs, which are a different art. They catch artists at work, but they catch them slightly less at work than they are when they're working for their director.
But that is what I think is so nice, because for the first time, you know, we're opening an exhibition like this. A lot of the content in this show has never been seen before. It all comes from deep file research, as I was saying. And I think it really does give and allows the general public, hopefully when they all come in to see it, the background and sort of some of the behind-the-scenes passion that went into creating movies as we see them today.
We finished up our little tour of the Getty Images Gallery in front of Tim Burton and the Batmobile. I think that's a huge behind smoke coming out of its exhaust. He's in front of that enormous set that he built at Pinewood for the early Batman films. There's a new Batman coming out very, very soon. And Tim Burton now lives here, of course. So that's a kind of totally prescient and iconic image, though. And I've never seen that shot before. And he looks young. He looks very pleased with himself to be atop the Batmobile. Who wouldn't be?
Well, this is a great big 4-foot-plus shot. It's absolutely stunning. And the amazing thing for me is that could be taken today. You know, if you, as you say, there's a new Batman film coming out, and I think he looks incredible. The whole colour and combination and setup there is really superb, something you've really got to come and see.
Louise, if people do want to come and see it, it's at the Getty Image Gallery. Give us your address, and it's free to the public as well, isn't it?
It is, of course it's free. We like everyone to come and visit us. We're 46 East Castle Street, that's London W1W, and we're open all during the week, including Saturdays 12 to 6.
And the other thing about this is that people can buy these. We must tell them, you can actually come in and buy this stuff, can't you?
Just like I've sold one to you, Jason. Yes, yeah, so prices here start at £65 and run all the way up, depending on the size and quality that you're actually wanting to buy. But we have something for everyone, everyone's taste and everyone's pocket.
Louise, thank you so much indeed.
I highly recommend a visit to the exhibition. It's free, as Louise said, and for our many North American listeners, the exhibition is indeed heading your way, opening at the Lincoln Center in New York in September, and then on to LA in November. But we also have the opportunity for one lucky Observer Film Weekly listener to win a print of their very own. It's the print of Richard Burton and Liz Taylor that I described in the exhibition. All you have to do is answer this simple question. It's a question of comprehension. Have you been listening well? In my interview with Louise, we spoke about one of the great pictures in front of me. Louise and I talked about a memorable image, the personnel of which would make up, I say, an amazing back four. Who is in that lineup? What would be finest England back four in living memory, according to that image. Send your entry in to film.weekly@observer.uk and you could win that wonderful picture of one of the great screen couples of all time relaxing with a glass of champagne and a tunic. It is absolutely brilliant and it's worth nearly £400. Finally, on Observer Film Weekly, the Canadian filmmaker Guy Maddin is the very definition of the auteur, an iconoclast who's built a cinematic style all of his own over the past two decades. My Winnipeg is a Freudian caper where Maddin documents his attempt to escape his hometown, a web of stories, emotions and associations. Guy Maddin came into the Guardian Studios to tell us more about Winnipeg and his ongoing preoccupation with fantasy, documentary and a blend of both, the docufantasia. Guy Maddin, welcome to Film Weekly.
A million thanks. It's great to be here.
It is great. I think you're definitely the first Winnipegger we've had on the show.
Wow, really?
Yeah, well, how many of you are there? There can't be that many.
I don't know. I guess Marsha McLuhan's dead now. He lived across the street from me, actually, on Gertrude Avenue back in Winnipeg.
Wow. I would love Woody Allen like to call on him and have him appear here.
So I know. Now he'll just have to drag me out, and I wouldn't really be much of an authority on anything.
Let's start with the actual genre that you seem to have invented over the last couple of films you did. I remember the one that you did with Isabella Rossellini about her father.
Right.
You called that a docufantasia, and I see you've called your new film, My Winnipeg, a docufantasia, which I think is a wonderfully ghoulish but also kind of delicious way into what on earth is a docufantasia?
Well, I'm glad you like the term. For the longest time, it was a term I was only using for myself, just so that I could have the courage to proceed, because I knew these things were documentaries, but I thought a lot of people would sort of balk at the notion that these things are documentaries. In the case of the Isabella Rossellini short, My Dad is 100 Years Old, she wrote her some kind of little memorial or I guess a little flashback to childhood with her father, the great Roberto Rossellini, on the occasion of his centennial. Now, she didn't do any fact-checking. She played the roles of Hitchcock and Fellini and David O. Selznick. And she was
really good. She was great at Hitchcock, wasn't she?
She loves going into drag. It's great. But I think she put her own words into their mouths, and they may have been horribly misrepresented for all I know or for all she cared. But she was going by how she remembered from her days as a little girl what the impressions these people gave her. And so the only research she conducted was research within her own heart and her own perhaps very unreliable memory. But it was a documentary because it was a documentary of her feelings. And so I thought it was a docufantasia, really, because it was mostly just dreamy, almost certainly misremembered notions. And it ends up just being a very honest, truthful, probably more honest than most documentaries, account of her heart.
We were talking to Alex Gibney, who did Taxi to the Dark Side, won the Oscar for that documentary, mm-hmm. and he just made a documentary called Gonzo about Hunter S. Thompson,
right.
One politician described Hunter S. Thompson's sort of methods of writing as the least factual but the most accurate.
Yeah.
So it's
perfect.
It seems to me is exactly what you're kind of getting to. You've taken that what Rossellini did there and kind of used it on your own memories and your own feelings, and we get this wonderful kind of relationship that
it
you
made
have.
Makes sense. With your who wants a bunch? Who anywhere, even in Winnipeg, wants to listen to a bunch of stats and facts about Winnipeg?
It does give you the excuse that you don't have to go to the library and kind of trawl through actual facts.
Yeah, there's no way I would have made a documentary about Winnipeg if I'd had to go to our we don't have a library in Winnipeg. We have a bookmobile. But if I'd had to wait for Thursday to come around for it to pull up in front of my place, no way. I knew if I could conduct the research in my heart, then it would be fine. I like the Herzog term, ecstatic truth, too. I think someone told me that's what it is that he uses, and it's the same thing. It's truer than truth. It's truer than facts. Facts can be manipulated, but when you're just sitting there, you know, lamenting, self-pitying, regretting, raging, those are real, honest feelings. And although, of course, you can manipulate your own feelings, too, but the very fact that you would choose these things is telling everybody something about yourself, and that can't be hidden, actually.
Guy, you've spent years delighting me with your images, and some of them are wild, some of them are mad, some of them are beautiful, some of them are indeed the saddest music in the world, which is your film from 2003. I've always felt that, you know, that your films are a bit of a secret to people, that you had your fans, you had a kind of cult following, mm-hmm. if you like, amongst the kind of the weirdies and the outsiders and the film critics who kind of get to see stuff anyway, so we don't have to seek it out. Suddenly you come along with My Winnipeg, which I thought, oh no, this is going to be really personal, really kind of inaccessible. But I think it's your most accessible film yet. I mean, I think it's your most beautiful and your most moving and your most hilarious film yet. I mean, I think that's amazing that it came out of this very kind of personal state.
I know. It's almost, I guess, in Pavlovian terms, it's just going to encourage me to spill my guts and open up even more. And really, you don't want to see any more of me. I'm already sitting here in the studio with my pants down around my ankles, you know, just hoping to get a few last squeezes out of myself for you today.
I have that effect on many guests, Guy. You're no one special, it has to be said. Tell us about Winnipeg. I mean, where is Winnipeg for those who haven't done geography?
Winnipeg is at the precise geographical center of North America. But, you know, if God were bored, say, on a Saturday and was spinning North America on the tip of his finger, we Winnipeggers would be treading just above God's cuticle, which actually wouldn't be a bad title for a folk song or
your next movie.
An album or my next movie, yes. Yes. Treading above God's cuticle, or just God's cuticle.
Now, you have clearly, from what emerges from the film, you have a love-hate relationship with it. You have tremendous affection for it. You have tremendous memories for the place.
Yeah.
And I think they're probably what appeals about the film to a wider audience is that everyone has these memories to their own hometown. Mine is London, you know, which is an enormous city which has been endlessly chronicled and written about and filmed. But one always has very personal relationships with. I mean, no one can have the relationship with my mother that I have. I'm the only person that can have that.
Yeah, there's millions of Londons, and there's 700,000 Winnipegs, and... Well, I'd really hoped with this movie, although I never dared utter these hopes, that to just pile up an Everest of Winnipeg specificities and somehow the sheer weight of those specific Winnipeg details would push through some barrier and make make the picture universal somehow. So, and strangely enough, some people seem to be finding themselves in the town.
Asleep on foot, the Winnipegger is a citizen of the night. The Winnipeg night. Why is this so? Why are we so sleepy? Why can't we just open our eyes? Is it the mystically paired river forks, the biomagnetic influence of our bison, the powerful northern lights? We don't know. We sleep.
Let's talk about some of those specifics then, because you have a strange relationship with the memory of the house where you grew up, which, I've got to confess here, was above a beauty parlor. Now, my father was a hairdresser. I grew up in a hair salon as well. So I had a tremendous kind of affection for your film there.
We might be sobbing into each other's bosoms by the end of this
podcast.
Well,
you ought to put your pants up first, I hope.
Okay.
Because you talk about the smell of the sound of clipping and cutting and haircuts and helmets drying and hair product. I mean, I smelled of hair lacquer for the first kind of few years of my life. I remember my father's fingers. That's what they smelled of every night when he came home.
Yeah.
Yours was, it seemed to be a wonderful place that's clearly affected you. And I mean, it came, when I found out that you grew up in a sort of hair salon, it kind of explained a lot to me, Guy.
Yeah. Well, my family salon had a clientele that was older, sort of I remember all the hair trimmings, which I used to play with when I was really young, were already gray. And then there was still like 20 years to go with the same customers.
Yes, I had and, those too.
And the hair trimmings got thinner and thinner and less healthy. And I guess some of the poor patrons were a little less there. Sometimes they'd be kind of just brought in on a gurney and have their hair done and then wheeled out again looking like $1 million. It was, you know, still sexy for me. And I've been pretty much trying to figure out just what happened to me ever since.
But then, strangely enough, looking at your film, and this is where it becomes even more sort of bizarre, you have a great relationship with the Winnipeg ice hockey team and their great stadium where you obviously fell in love with ice hockey. And I think you have to be obviously into ice hockey in Winnipeg because it seems to be the main kind of lifeblood of the town.
Yeah, but it's still sports and you could connect through football easily. I had two homes. Grew up in the beauty salon, especially in my preschool years. But then when I got old enough, my father started taking me to the ice hockey rink where he ran a couple of really great teams for the first 14 years of my life. So I spent a lot of time, was even born at the ice hockey rink. I was on the night of a big blizzard in February, and my mom went into early labor, and it just seemed better where there were a couple of team doctors just to have the delivery right there in the dressing room rather than risk getting caught in a snowbank on the way to the hospital. And so I was, you know, just to watch this lovely arena, this being demolished pointlessly just for some, you know, political kickbacks involving, you know, the development of some cheap new piece of crap.
But I think that the thing is that what you've done, I think, is found what writers have often tried to do is find a correlative for memory. It's such a fragmented way.
Yeah.
Strange enough, this week I saw Bruce Weber's Chop Suey just before yours.
Right.
Again, it's a kind of sifting exercise in fragments and memory and collective consciousness, but very personal. And you've managed to kind of blend your normal kind of use of silent movies, back projections,
right,
and kind of hallucinogenic kind of exploration into this kind of, that's how your memories come to you. Is that what you see in the kind of inner workings of your mind or your inner projected?
The whole structure scene, I've always wanted to do things that only books could do rather than, and I don't mean make bookish movies, you know, not make a masterpiece theater kind of thing, but just thing that just produce those little narcotic tingles that a perfectly turned metaphor on the page can produce in a reader while in a private engagement with the book. And here it just seemed like I had the same freedom a writer has to just time travel and as much as I wanted. And you know, I like the Faulkner conviction that the past and the present coexist simultaneously, that there isn't any nifty categorization of the past in a separate bin from the present. You know, anyone who approaches a hot stove element knows that the past and present exist simultaneously. You can't help but think of previous encounters.
There's, I suppose we can't leave without mentioning Anne Savage, who plays your mum in the film. She could be. I was thinking, is she his mum?
Because
I
began to get confused. Anne Savage, the most frightening femme fatale in film noir history, and the star of Edgar G. Ulmer's Detour, 1945, and she'd been retired for 51 years when I was able to woo her about a 3-month-long telephone campaign out of retirement and get her to listen to the slate clack again. And there's my mother is special. She's a force of nature, and there is only one woman on the planet. Thank God she was still around and willing to do this that could play her, and that's Anne Savage. And
she's a kind of luminous presence. She looks, well, I don't know how much work you had to do to her, but she looks great.
I didn't have to do any work. She does her own makeup. She gets up at 4 a.m. every day, does her own makeup, whether she's in a movie or not, puts on her jewels and her mink. She goes out and she studies people on the sidewalk. She lives right in Hollywood. She goes out and does character studies of people, just watching them. You know, if you see a really elegant, silver-haired, luminous octogenarian walking around the streets of Hollywood, you're probably being studied by her.
So, Guy, I mean, congratulations on the film My Winnipeg. It really is an arresting piece of footage, memorabilia, personal love. I mean, it really has everything in there. I don't know how you knew when to stop, you know, putting more memories in. The wonderfully haunting scene where the horses' heads are frozen in the ice.
Yeah, like I could have filled at least the entire movie with just frozen animal stories from Winnipeg.
They're all true, are they?
Yeah, they really are, as implausible as they are. If I made one mistake, it's just that each story was so fantastic that one after the other, they really take on the accumulatory effect of just bullcrap, but they're all true.
And the pictures we've seen, are they actual pictures of those horses?
Yeah,
frozen?
there's some archival footage.
Because they're like, I don't know, I suppose like Skittles in a way, or Anthony Gormley sculptures. You know, he did the ones on the beaches recently. They look like that, but they're
it's really
horses'
weird.
Heads.
I my theory is, watching the river freeze up in Winnipeg for so many winters now, is that the water gets quite low at that time, and the horses were actually standing on the bottom of the river when the ice that was, you know, sort of freezing up in big chunks sort of locked them into place and then really froze them, and they died of exposure at exactly the same height, and the muscles in their necks just kept their heads upright, and there they sat for the whole winter, and that's 5.5 months. Very odd. Apparently people were, by the end of the winter, at first it was very romantic and people would go and just stare at the strange, surreal tableau of so many horses propped up like knights on a chessboard. But by the end of the winter, the novelty had worn off and vandals were just cutting their ears off and perhaps making horse ear soup out of it or something, or carving their initials in these things. I don't know. You know, it's human nature.
Using them to reenact The Godfather or something.
Exactly.
I mean, to me, that's that was always previously, obviously, the most famous horse's head moment in cinema. I think
Right. You've
outdone Coppola there.
More horses.
That's
yeah,
what
The
we
Godfather
need.
Only had one horse yeah, head. I had 11.
Yeah, 11 horses' heads, beautifully arranged.
Better than one.
It is, isn't it? Guy, congratulations again. Thank you so much for coming. I see that your film has actually sort of started. I don't know if it's Soda Pictures who are releasing your film here in the UK. They've sort of asked other people to kind of do docu-fantasies about their own hometown to go
with
it.
Oh, yeah, it was this great contest. I'm really thrilled. I want to see some of these pictures. I think you go to yourwinnipeg.co.uk and find out details. But you're invited to make a 3-minute portrait, prose, poem, documentary portrait or whatever of your own hometown, no matter what it is. Shoot it on any format, cell phone to IMAX, everything in between. And winner gets a round trip ticket to Winnipeg, £1,500, broadcast slot on Channel 4, and I think a slot in a film festival somewhere. And
it does sound like that famous old joke about first prize, 1 week in Winnipeg, second prize, 2 weeks.
it does kind of feel that way, doesn't it? Well, I guess you could just maybe have the flight routed through New York and just get off there and take the £1,500 and have a weekend in New York or something.
No, well, you can always go and see Guy Madden's film, My Winnipeg. Guy, well, thanks you for being a wonderful guest on Film Weekly. You can pull your pants back up now.
Ah, zip.
A huge thanks to Guy Madden there, and to all my guests this week, to Tom McCarthy, director of The Visitor, and to the Getty Images Gallery for their wonderful offer of that prize portrait of Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. If you want to comment on any of the films we feature, do check out our blog at guardian.co.uk/blogs. And of course, for the best film news and reviews to be found each week, look in the Observer newspaper on Sunday and online at guardian.co.uk/films. But for now, from me, Jason Solomon, and my producer, Jason Phipps. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.